Welcome everyone. Thank you for being here. I will go around and say hello, starting with Jinryu. Jim? Drew? Chris? Yashitsuki? Mark? Dave? Gaffel? Bob, Qua, Karen, Tyler, Marv, Shoketsu, Joan, Betty, Linda R, Erica, and Ruth Ann. All right. Welcome, and let's see. Looks like a whole bunch of people ended up unmuted, so you might want to mute yourselves. Let's see. In terms of announcements, a week from today, we will be hosting this activity from the Zendo. So if you are local, you have the option of attending at the Zendo or online. We have some safety COVID protocols. You need to show proof of full vaccination, and we'll be wearing masks. There's a limit on numbers. The Zendo is set up to have 14 seats. So I don't think we're going to hit that anytime soon. A lot of people are still, you know, choosing to remain at home. But there's also a couple big air purifiers in the room and whatever. So we'll try to make things as safe as possible. And we'll do the Tuesday recitations in the Zendo. But on Sundays, when we do the vigorous chanting, we'll be listening to a recording instead of, you know, actually having a chant leader bellowing the chant out in the Zendo. So we're doing little adaptations like that, and no tea and cookies for now, that kind of thing. But hopefully, if you are inclined, you will join us in the Zendo. And then those of you who are online, you can if you haven't already submitted your proof of vaccination card, please bring your vaccination card, and then there'll be a greeter at the door who will add you to our list. And but if you are joining from Zoom, that you will just see that one of the cameras will be on the Zendo, and everything else will be pretty much the same. And do we have a fundraiser announcer? Jim, yes, Jim. You are still muted.
That happened. There we go. All right. Tomorrow is the last day of our fundraiser drive, and all of us on the fundraising committee are thrilled with the response, and we're grateful for your support and to simply get to connect with all of you. And we've reached more than double our original goal for our first ever campaign. If you still wish to take part, we'd love to connect with you and have you be a part of it. So thank you all.
Yeah, and there will be a little closing write-up in the newsletter this week about that. On another note, let's see, some people have asked about Rohatsu Retreat. That's last year we had an online Rohatsu. This year I will be going in person to Great Vow Zen Monastery for retreat, which if you are around anywhere nearby, I encourage you to consider that possibility. They will have an online option as well. So if you do want to do an online retreat, you can participate in theirs online. And I don't know if you'll be able to see me in the Zendo, but there might be a couple of us from Brightway who end up going. And they will have, it's proof of vaccination required, and you have to get a test within 3 days of going. So they're trying to be as safe as they can be. So that, and that's the first week of December, December 1st through the 8th. And when I get a chance, I'll put a note about that in the newsletter so you can think about that, because retreat is a very important part of our practice. Any other announcements I should make or questions about anything? All right. Any anyone want to make an announcement about like the podcast group?
I know we're just leaving it to the newsletter.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so just a reminder, there is a Thursday evening podcast discussion group, and it meets a little bit earlier in the day than this event. So it's a little friendlier to those in more easterly time zones. Okay, Erica.
I actually did have a quick question about when we go back to meeting in person. So I've never actually been able to come in person, because I joined when the pandemic was already happening. So like on Tuesday nights, is it okay to come after 7 p.m.? Like, or do you really want people to be there right when it starts?
That is a very good question. We are very, especially because our numbers are still quite small at Brightway. I mean, maybe someday when we're a giant Zendo with like 70 people, we'll say, hey, but actually, even then, it would be fine to arrive late. We would just ask you to wait for a certain time to enter the Zendo. But as it is, we're just like, eh, just come on in and sit down quietly and join us wherever we are. So it's fine. We're very flexible about arriving late or leaving early. Okay. So tonight we're continuing on the nine fields of Zen practice, which I believe everybody is aware of the nine fields and where to find them. On the Zen Studies podcast website, we have covered the fields of Zazen and Dharma study, cultivating insight, and precepts. And tonight we are on to opening the heart, exploring non-separation from all being. So just a reminder that there are recordings of the previous classes, thanks to Bob, who not only records them, but processes them and then posts them and puts the links on our website. So if you go to the website, resources, recordings, you can either watch a Zoom recording of the class or listen to the audio. So you can catch up on past classes. All right, so opening the heart, exploring non-separation from all being. I want to invite you, as usual, to stop me at any time with questions. I do have plenty to say, but I don't particularly like being a talking head. I know that's not as engaging as something that's more interactive. So if you have any questions, just hit the reactions button at the bottom of your screen and choose raise hand, and then a little hand will just stay at the top of your screen until I have a chance to get to you. Or if you don't want to bother with that, you can always just try to flag my attention. I'm happy to stop at any point. There are two take-home messages for tonight, so I will revisit them. Well, first, and we are going to talk for a moment, like, what do we really mean by opening the heart? But let's say the first take-home message is opening our heart toward all beings is not something we do only for the sake of others. An open heart is a manifestation of enlightenment. It's an outcome of enlightenment. And a closed heart is incompatible with enlightenment. So it's something we do not just for the sake of others, but also for ourselves, self and other benefit equally. And the second message is that there are two paths to an open heart. And really there's two paths to anything that we want to achieve in our practice. But here's an example. So two paths, insight and what I'm calling enactment. Bodhidharma calls it insight and practice. But the gist of it is that cultivating insight, the way that we talked about a couple weeks ago, which is cultivating a personal knowledge, a personal experience of suffering, what causes suffering, and what leads to the end of suffering, and cultivating a personal, deepening personal understanding of the emptiness or boundlessness of self. Cultivating that insight leads to a more open heart, but cultivating a more open heart also leads to insight. So this is like, it's two kind of paths to the same place. So I'll talk more about that. So first of all, I thought I forgot to get this pulled up right away. I thought we might brainstorm a little bit about what do we mean by open heart. So let's see. Gotta try to pull up one of my little shared documents here. Oh, no, that's not the one. There we go. I'll share my screen. All right, so opening the heart. That's just kind of my chosen way to express this. But I wanted to do a little brainstorming about what does it mean to have an open heart, or to have to open the heart, or to have an open heart as opposed to a closed one. What are some other ways that we might describe this thing that we're looking for? Go ahead and just unmute yourself. And Dave.
The first thing that springs to my mind is being sort of available to other people.
Mm.
Being compassionate towards others, towards all others.
Mm-hmm. Assume good intentions.
And not judging others. Bearing witness to other people's stories.
Being generous.
Listening to other people.
Being grateful.
Perhaps also letting go of any grudges or resentment.
Mm.
empathizing or trying to understand other people's positions or ways?
Recognizing our connection with everything around us, everything and everyone.
To treat people equally.
Seeing others' humanity.
Recognize when other people aren't being treated equally.
It occurred to me that for some reason there's a certain kind of fearlessness associated with open-heartedness, undefendedness.
Like being vulnerable?
Mm.
Reminds me of that.
Allowing other people to care for you.
Mm. Oops.
To be patient with yourself and others.
Being there for those in need, those who are suffering.
Respecting someone else's opinion or perspective, even if it doesn't agree with how I look at things.
Mm-hmm.
Don't believe everything you think.
Well, it seems to me like opening the heart or an open heart manages to point toward a lot. I'm glad to see that it evokes everything, you know, as varied from non-judgment to generosity to listening, empathizing. Nice. Should add in here goodwill, which is something we're going to be talking about. Just wishing well for beings unconditionally. Sympathetic joy. Another Brahma Vihara, which is being happy for beings when they are, when they have good fortune.
Where would a sense of sort of wonder and curiosity fit into that? I don't know if it's already been.
It's interesting because I was realizing as I wrote my notes for this class, I was really thinking in terms of, you know, open-heartedness toward other people, which is a place we start, but it does seem like there's really no limit to it. And open-heartedness toward other people often just means, you know, the open heart lets us appreciate everything, more and be more grateful for everything and more touched by everything. So I think that fits right in.
Following on that, maybe this is too specific, but making sure people know that their suffering isn't weird.
How about the letting people know they aren't alone? So as we look at this list, I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of compare and contrast Buddhism's approach to this opening the heart with various approaches taken in other religions. And I don't mean to be critical of other religions, but more in terms of just because most of us have been more exposed to other religious traditions than Buddhism, that we kind of come with a certain set of understanding, expectations, assumptions about this kind of, these kinds of qualities. So a lot of times in other traditions, these are all, you know, virtues and behaviors that are valued. They're always, you know, acknowledged as being a good thing. But many times it's, you know, this is the expectation of God that he or she wants you to be this way. So to fulfill that expectation, you should be that way, or you should be this way because, you know, there's a creator and the creator created these beings and these things, and so you should treat them with respect. Other traditions, this kind of behavior helps you be reborn in a better place, whether that is heaven or in a future life, you have a better rebirth. Or, you know, it's a virtue that you develop amongst virtues. And all of this is fine, but it can make altruism, if you will, seem like something of an add-on or an extra, something that, you know, helps you gain merit or virtue, or but it has, in a sense, that it has little to do with your own happiness or your own spiritual progress. And that's not, of course, entirely true. Every religion has their more mystical aspects. But I do think Buddhism is remarkable in how it portrays open-heartedness, a term I chose and made up. It's not a difficult Buddhist term, but just kind of covering all of this. It portrays open-heartedness as inseparable from a spiritual path that is aimed at individual liberation. So we are aimed at, you know, our own greater wisdom and compassion and freedom and happiness. And what Buddhism says is, like, these kinds of qualities are inseparable from that path. So I'll talk about how that is. So back when we were talking about cultivating insight, I talked about how the two main things that I see us trying to awaken to is the nature of suffering and how to release ourselves from suffering. The origin of suffering being desire, and learning how to let go of desire and let go of dukkha, that additional suffering that we add onto things. So that was one thing that we were supposed to try to gain a personal, very personal understanding of. And then the true nature of self as empty and boundless. So I'll talk about how open-heartedness relates to both of those pieces of insight. In terms of freedom from suffering, the central matter, as we find, as we study the teachings and we try to realize them for ourselves, the central matter is letting go of I, me, and mine. Or as the traditional sutras say, I making, my making, and mine making, the creation of I, me, and mine. We recognize how self-grasping leads to suffering, and letting go of self-grasping leads to a release of suffering. So we say dukkha or dissatisfactoriness, the source of it is desire. Desire is self-centered. Desire for our experience to be other than how it is. So I wanted to share a really great passage by Tanisiro Bhikkhu, one of my favorite Buddhist scholars. And he's talking here about self and how the practice of anatta or not self is something that the Buddha recommended. So in a way, so I'm going to talk about this practice of not self, of learning to give up self-attachment. And then I'm going to talk about how cultivating open-heartedness is like the positive side of letting go of self-attachment. So Tanisiro says the question becomes, so he's saying the Buddha didn't teach that there's no self. He just said what views of self are useful and what views of self are not useful. He said, when is the perception of a self a skillful action that leads to long-term welfare and happiness? And when is the perception of not self a skillful action that leads to long-term welfare and happiness? So he says, we already engage in these perceptions about self all of the time and have been doing so ever since we were children. We have many different perceptions of self. Each sense of self is strategic and a means to an end. Each comes with a boundary, inside of which is self and outside of which is not self. And so our sense of what's self and what's not self keeps changing all of the time, depending on our desires and what we think will lead to true happiness. Take an example from your childhood. Suppose you have a younger sister, and someone down the street is threatening her. You want to protect her. At that moment, she is very much your sister. She belongs to you, and you will do whatever you can to protect her. Then suppose that, when you've brought her home safely, she begins to play with your toy car and won't give it back to you. Now she's no longer your sister. She's the other. Your sense of yourself and what is yours and not yours has shifted. The boundary line between self and not self has changed. You've been doing this sort of thing, changing the boundaries of what's self and what's not self all the time. Think back on your life, even for just a day, to see the many times your sense of self has changed from one role to another. Normally, we create a sense of self as a strategy for gaining happiness. We look for what abilities we have in order to gain a happiness we want. Those abilities are then ours. The hand we use to reach for the object we want is our hand. The loud voice we can use to scare off the bullies threatening our sister is our voice. This is why the element of control is so essential to our sense of self. We assume that the things we can control are us or ours. Then we also try to think about which part of ourselves will live to enjoy the happiness we're trying to gain. These things will change depending on the desire. Unfortunately, our desires tend to be confused and incoherent. We're also unskillful in our understanding of what happiness is. Thus, we often end up with an inconsistent and misinformed collection of selves. You can see this clearly as you meditate. You find that the mind contains many different inner voices expressing many conflicting opinions as to what you should and shouldn't be doing to be happy. We instinctively know that our strategies of self-making are for the sake of happiness. So we misunderstand the Buddha's not-self-teaching, thinking that it's a no-self-teaching and that he's trying to deny us of ourselves. We're afraid that he's trying to deprive us of our strategies for finding happiness and protecting the happiness we've found. That's why we resist the teaching. But when we gain a proper understanding of his teaching, we see that his aim is to teach us how to use perceptions of self and not self as strategies leading to a happiness that's reliable and true. So the positive way, the positive aspect of practicing not self, I mean, there are practices for, like, you know, trying to disentangle your attachment to things and to senses of yourself and all that. But a kind of another way to get there are the cultivation of things such as the four Brahma Viharas or divine abidings. So these are portrayed by the Buddha as prerequisites for spiritual practice, namely goodwill, which is alternately translated as loving kindness or love or something. I kind of like good will because it's not quite as sentimental sounding as loving kindness. Sometimes, you know, you need to have goodwill for all beings. And there are some beings it might be a little difficult to summon warm loving kindness for, but at the very least, we're going to have goodwill for them. And then compassion, which that's when you feel goodwill for a being and you see them suffer, you feel compassion. And then sympathetic joy. So when you feel goodwill for a being and you see them happy, then you feel happy on their behalf. And then equanimity. So these are prerequisites for spiritual practice. And equanimity seems like kind of cool and different, but really it's like big-heartedness. So you're not all kind of wrapped up and reactive to being, so that you can actually be more open-hearted to them, if you will. So if you are, on the contrary, you are full of ill will, indifference, envy, reactivity, you will be agitated and fixated on self. Your sense of self and habits of self-attachment will be strengthened. No matter how much you meditate or study or contemplate the teachings or mechanically act out the precepts, all the fields of Zen that we've talked about so far, if your heart remains closed, you will not make much progress. And I don't mean to say like it's an either or thing, of course, just like everything else we've talked about. It's a spectrum of growth. We don't have an open heart or a closed heart. We're somewhere in between. So goodwill, the foundational aspect of open-heartedness, is a sign of letting go of some obsession with the small self. Now, goodwill may be easy to feel for certain people who have been very kind to us or don't threaten us, or children or animals or something we can feel goodwill for. But the spiritual practice of goodwill is learning to extend that sense of goodwill in a more unconditional way to anyone. So that becomes the practice of it. And as we do that, what is the first thing we encounter as we're trying to extend metta beyond the people that we like? Oh, you know, immediately that is our self-concern arising, our defensiveness, our judgment. And so, as I'm going to talk about later, like actually cultivating metta is another way to approach that self-attachment and to soften it and work on it. So yes, the goodwill is the positive side of letting go of self-attachment. And it's what naturally happens. So in the delusion of a separate, inherently existing self, that is what we add to the situation. When that falls away, we see that everything is impermanent. There's no fixed boundaries between us and other beings. We're dependently co-arisen with all beings, and naturally goodwill occurs. So again, as we say, it's like these are different manifestations of enlightenment. The open-heartedness is a result, but it also can be a cause. So another any questions or thoughts before I go on to the Bodhisattva vow? All right, just feel free to raise your hand at any time. So another opening the heart practice, a Mahayana opening the heart practice, of course, is the Bodhisattva vow, where we vow to free all beings along with ourselves. So we're saying, you know, we're in this with everybody. I'm not just going to go off and try to attain some great peace or enlightenment or liberation or something and then leave everybody else behind. That my well-being is tied to the well-being of all. And I want to emphasize that the Bodhisattva vow is not an extra credit project for spiritual athletes. That's actually kind of how it was perceived in original Buddhism. In original Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, like, they had bodhisattvas, but bodhisattvas were like, you know, you weren't just going to be an arhat and completely awaken. You were going for the gold. But in Mahayana, it turned it on its head and said, this is something we should all be aspiring to. So it's not an extra credit project. It is the aspect of our practice which keeps us from falling into duality. It's the other half of awakening, if you will. So we might have the awakening to what we call the absolute, or what I'm calling the independent dimension, where you perceive that all being is empty of inherent, enduring, independent self nature. Ultimately, there's only one seamless reality of this moment. Even suffering is contained within that seamless reality. Nothing is a problem. Nothing compromises the luminosity of this moment. Nothing whatsoever needs to be done. Okay, so let's say you have a little sense of that, insight into that. Great. That perception is very liberating. But that's only half. And if you only see that half, if you're obsessed with that half, and you think that half, that's what's true. And it's true, but it's not the only thing that's true. It's a dangerous state to be stuck and think that is the only thing that is true. You need to simultaneously awaken to how the dependent dimension of reality, dimension of time and space and causality, right and wrong and differentiation, is not something separate or lesser. It's absolutely inseparable and mutually interdependent with that independent dimension of luminosity and perfection. There's nothing that's just one dimensional. both dimensions are reflected in reality. So you also have to awaken to how each and every last thing is holy and of the utmost importance, and that the suffering of any being is also your suffering. So the, like at the what seems like perhaps the polar opposite is the bodhisattva who vows to free every last being before, you know, disappearing off into nirvana. So we work on understanding emptiness and on manifesting our bodhisattva vow in tandem, because each dimension needs a different practice. So it's like they're medicines for different issues. And, you know, that's why you get in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, for instance, you talk about the bodhisattva who works for the good of the world, all beings, tirelessly, but does not get stuck in the concept of a being or a self or saving. So it's like the bodhisattva has cultivated that insight of emptiness, but also great compassion. So I hope this is a very immense topic, I realized as I was writing this class. So I think probably tomorrow and next week I'll just be like, oh my God, I totally didn't talk about this whole aspect or that whole aspect. But anyway, this is the impressionist painting you get of this topic from me today. So that is about, hopefully you get something across about how an open heart and kind of selflessness and lack of self-attachment and, you know, open to all beings is a completely integrated part of our practice. But now I'm going to talk about the two paths of, like, so how do we cultivate opening the heart? This is Bodhidharma's outline of practice. Very, very short little piece. And in it, he talks about there being two paths. This text is called Two Entrances. It says, now in entering the path, there are many roads. To summarize them, they reduce to two types. The first is entrance by principle, and the second is entrance by practice. Entering by principle means that one awakens to the thesis by means of the teachings. And one deeply believes that all living beings, common and sagely, are identical to true nature. And it is merely because of the unreal covering of adventitious dust that the true nature is not revealed. This path is non-discriminative, quiescent, and inactive. We call it entrance by principle. Entering by practice means the four practices, for all other practices are included within these. What are the four? The first is the practice of requiting injury. The second is the practice of following conditions. The third is the practice of having nothing to be sought. And the fourth is the practice of according with Dharma. So I'm not going to go into what all those things mean, but just the takeaway message of there being these two paths of practice. So in other words, we may make progress, if you will, on the path, greater freedom, wisdom, compassion, through what I'm going to call insight, or through what I'm going to call enactment. Practices like precepts, karma work, mindfulness, study, opening the heart, as we're going to talk about. Stuff we work at, stuff that we do. And of course, these two paths are not mutually exclusive. You don't pick one or the other. You know, our field, Zen fields, include trying to cultivate insight and Zazen. but we also do all these other practices. Because when we enact the truth, when, for instance, in metta practice, we try to feel goodwill and we try to extend it to beings, even if we don't really have the insight to feel it sincerely yet, it still changes us. So I thought of this analogy, and I'm not sure how well it holds, but we'll see. So you probably heard the analogy for enlightenment or awakening as being like you have mistaken a rope for a snake, but then you see it's just a rope. So this is like our delusions, you know, that are causing us such distress, and then we see, oh, I was completely wrong about that. So in that instant of insight where we perceive the rope as a rope, our fear just disintegrates. So this is the power of insight. When we see things clearly, you know, the veils can fall away, things can shift. And let's say the kind of enactment, the practice approach, maybe somebody tells us we have nothing to fear from this snake. So we still have our continued apprehension. We're still damn sure it's a snake. But, you know, we get up the courage and we walk by the snake and we start to walk by it on a regular basis. And then pretty soon we're pretty much not that scared of it anymore. I mean, it still looks a lot like a snake, but it's never reached out to bit us. We never noticed it move. So we start not to be afraid of it. And then one day, we look at it right, and then we notice that it is just a rope. So some of us definitely dream of walking. We want to walk the path of insight because it sounds a lot quicker and easier and cleaner. You know, I just want to get it. And then, and then all my fears will melt away and I'll all be good. But frankly, we don't have a lot of choice in the matter. And like I said, they're really like 2 feet in walking. No one just suddenly has great insight about these deep Buddhist truths, having had no preparation. So we do all these other practices, and we don't wait around until we have some kind of profound saintly insight into our non-separation from all beings before we start to act like that. That would be really selfish, frankly. Probably would be really getting in the way of our spiritual practice. So in the meantime, we work on opening our hearts in whatever way we can. And there are specific practices to do, but then of course there's an infinite number of informal, personal ways to work on this. And maybe we'll have a chance to share a few of them. And so the classic example is metta practice, which probably many of you are familiar with, but the gist of it is there's several different verses that you say something like, may you be free from fear and anxiety. May you be at ease. May you be happy. And you're calling to mind some being as you sit in meditation, or maybe at some other quiet time, you're calling to mind, and you generally are supposed to start with a being for whom it's easy to feel this, so that you can summon the feeling. And, you know, a child, a pet, a being for whom it's unconditional. It's, you know, there's no self involved there, just goodwill. So we kind of practice feeling it. You know, kind of using this easy object. And then we try to kind of keep that feeling and then call another being to mind. Some being for whom it is perhaps just a little more difficult to, it's not as simple. Still somebody that we like, but it's a little more complicated. somewhere along in this process, depending on what your relationship with yourself is like, this also has to be extended toward the self. And I don't know if Westerners are just weird compared to previous cultures, or if all cultures have been like this, but I think many of us find, like, if you're going from the easy to the really difficult, the self is pretty far along toward the difficult end of this, in terms of sending real goodwill to ourself, unconditional. Usually find yourself sending, you know, may you be happy, and then there's little conditions, like as soon as you, you know, like little condition, like, you know, you better not, just no, don't relax and be happy, not until you're fixed, not until you've taken care of this. Or so it's very difficult to feel that kind of unmitigated goodwill toward ourselves. But that is an important part of this whole opening the heart process. So again, like, I could go on and on and on, but, you know, opening the heart with other people is a huge part of this, and we learn a lot. But certainly opening our hearts to ourselves and the whole process of getting to know the self and self-healing is, I don't think it can be overemphasized. I mean, Zen is not a psychotherapy path. There's other disciplines that have more, you know, constructive tools for examining your issues and processing the past and, you know, processing your emotions and things like that. But Zen certainly supports that general idea that until we can recognize, to at least accept the possibility of our own Buddha nature, then our heart is still closed. Even if it's only closed to ourselves, it is still closed. And that closedness is still tied up with a sense of self. So in a way, it's ironic, because you'd think, like, we're supposed to be, like, letting go of interest in the self, letting go of attachment to the self. But there's this ironic thing about, like, as long as there is a closed heart or a judgment of the self, we're still holding on to the self. So anyway, metta practice then can be done, you know, regularly, and many people find that it, you know, really does change your attitudes over time. But then there's certainly all kinds of ways that we can do this in interpersonal relationships, practicing patience and generosity and compassion, willingly spending time with people who maybe, you know, aren't the easiest people to spend time with, testing ourselves a little. As some people mentioned, maybe kind of studying the other side when we find ourselves full of judgment for certain people or groups of people, trying to soften the heart in some way to understand more about where they come from, or getting to know them personally and, you know, melting the heart a little bit like that. And then just kind of in closing, like, this opening the heart is, again, it's not just about people either. It's not just about other human beings or even ourselves. There's a certain kind of undefendedness and intimacy that we're looking for, that that hopefully will be an outcome of other aspects of our practice, insight, but can also be more directly cultivated. So I will leave it there. We only have 5 minutes. Any questions or reflections on opening the heart? Dave.
You opened it for reflections. I've just been thinking about how, when you were talking about self compassion, you instantly sort of started talking to yourself in the third person. Like as soon as you do this or as soon as you do that. And it seems, I feel as if that's, we kind of other the parts of ourselves that we don't like so much. And so there has, so for the love of yourself, it feels like there has to be some kind of level of acceptance that this is, this whole thing is me, the parts that I like or dislike or whatever. I don't know. That's just something that's been, it popped into my head. I don't know what you might have to say about that.
Absolutely. And that's where I feel like, you know, it is, it feels like 2 feet in walking, right? We're working on the self-acceptance, but in a way, cultivating the insight and really perceiving the emptiness of self is like, I can't, the most self-healing thing ever. Because essentially what you wake up to is that all of that shit doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. I mean, yeah, on the relative side, yeah, it matters, but it essentially, like, it doesn't defile our true nature. And that, then it, like, that kind of self-acceptance becomes a lot lighter, a lot easier. But, you know, as Dogen says, to study Buddhism is to study the self. So as we do start to turn toward ourselves, we're aware all the time, but certainly we come face to face with our insufficiencies, our selfishness, our judgment, our bad habits, all that. And yeah, facing that and accepting that. And I had a Zen teacher who said, what she described her process as, this healing process, was joining the human race. I was recognizing, you know, I don't have it. I'm not worse than other people. And I find compassion for other people. So why can't I give myself a break like I give other people a break? I find myself, after quite a number of these classes, I find myself just, I don't know, wishing we could go into it even more, because I would love to hear people's stories of opening the heart, examples of in your life and practice where, you know, you've managed to open your heart to someone or in a situation that it was a little closed, and you managed to increase that compassion or patience. Or, and I'll just leave you with this suggestion as kind of an exercise, it's a little related to the metta practice, but maybe looking for where you naturally find yourself feeling open-hearted. And then just kind of recall that feeling or notice that feeling and examine what is so in that situation. You know, what is the self like in that situation? And I would guess for most of us, you know, it's a situation where we feel comfortable and unthreatened, where we feel like we belong, where we feel like we have something to give. You know, there's an open-heartedness that really comes out when our friends are in need, when we can respond to that need in a very natural way without wondering if whether our gifts are going to be rejected. It's very, very rich practice. All right, so I'll wrap it up there with our closing verse. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Domio.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Good night. Good dreams.
You too.